Hey, everybody, thank you so much for listening to this episode of the Preacher Boys podcast. I make this show for you, and I hope that you really enjoy it. I have a lot of people that ask me how they can support the show financially, and you can do that by heading over to patreon.com/preacherboys. You're going to get access to exclusive content, including early releases of episodes. I've got a couple episodes right now that have been released at least a month early over on Patreon. You've got access to things like unique merch, depending on what tier you join, and you get access to some behind the scenes content that I'm posting within the group. So head over to patreon.com/preacherboys and become a member over there today. Every single supporter helps make this show a little bit more possible, especially as I continue to add additional episodes and content every single week. Thank you so much for tuning in. Let's get back to the show.
Trigger warning. This podcast contains descriptions of various abusive situations. Listener discretion is advised.
The church has made their decisions and made their bed, and you're not responsible for that.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not responsible for that. That's why I'm on this podcast. Like, I'm not covering for anybody anymore. Right. Like, that's their problem. I'm not here because I hate them. It's actually the opposite. Like, I want people to realize that, like, I still care. And, but you have to stand on the truth. You have to, like, or else it's going to crumble, going to fall. Eventually, it will.
Right.
And so, yeah, I guess I would just encourage that like, count the cost of the lies.
You are listening to the Preacher Boys podcast, a podcast shedding light on decades of mental, physical, and sexual abuse within the independent fundamental Baptist movement. The testimonies shared on this podcast are told from the personal experience and perspective of the survivors. Not all legal outcomes are known or final. Any suspect is presumed innocent until proven guilty in the court of law. To find more information about the Preacher Boys podcast and upcoming documentary, visit PreacherBoysDoc.com or connect on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter with the handle @PreacherBoysDoc. Now, here is your host, Eric Skwarzynski.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the Preacher Boys podcast. I'm really excited to be joined by Angie and Norman today on the podcast. Can the two of you just introduce yourselves and just give me a little bit of background about how you got introduced to the Independent Baptist movement?
My name is Angie, and I was introduced from birth because my dad and my mom, they're missionaries to the Arctic of Canada, so I was basically born and raised in it. And so, yeah, all my life I've been that.
Mm-hmm. And I'm Norman here. For myself, my mom got, actually she got saved, witnessed to by Angie's sister. And my mom started going to church. My sister actually was led to the Lord by Angie. So the family's pretty closely connected there. So they started going to church, and I was about 10 years old. I was kind of like dragged kicking and screaming into church because, you know, I'm 10 years old and it's boring. And
right.
Yeah, so that's where I got introduced. I didn't get saved until like, I don't know, like 15. And I think that's where I really started like actually, you know, serving in church and finding stuff to help. And right. Be a hand in the ministry and not just sit there and sleep or whatever. So.
Right. So, I mean, closely knit from the beginning then. But I mean, Angie, yours was from, like you said, from birth. So for you, this was the norm from very early on. And then it sounds like from your perspective, you were kind of the, oh, culture shock. Like we're going from not being involved. Were you religious at all up until that point? Or
I have very Catholic aunties.
Okay.
And I went to a couple church services. They have like a really, it's like an igloo shaped Catholic church.
Okay.
And I just remember that because it looks so cool. And they outside get in just like a regular church.
Right.
So my mom was, I think, in and out with like Catholic, Anglican. It's kind of right. like one or the other up in the north. So
right.
that's the only, you know, funerals, Easter, Christmas, stuff
yeah.
like that.
Yeah. yeah. So would you say initially, would you say, I mean, obviously you said you were kind of bored by it, but like, did you feel like any kind of like, why are we doing this? Or what's the point of us being here? Or was it just kind of like, it is what it is. I'll just grin and bear it for now.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, what was cool was like my mom and sister, they were like really encouraging to me as like a little kid yeah. seeing this. Cause, you know, the weird stuff came later with seeing what we're in, but what I saw as like a 10-year-old was my mom and sister praying and mm. God answering and things in the home better. And yeah. So that was like, I was like, oh, this is, you know, this is cool.
Yeah.
You know, as much as a 10-year-old can think, you know.
Right. Yeah. It wasn't overtly negative. It was it was pretty positive in a lot of areas.
Yeah. Yeah. Sure. Yeah. Sure. Totally.
And Angie, would you say that you had pretty positive feelings toward the movement? I mean, obviously when you're born into it, it's what you know. So yeah. it generally is, but was it pretty positive for you initially as well?
I would say for the most part, yes. There was, I think like every pastor's family, there's like some stuff that goes behind the scenes where, you know, we're like pushed and raised on a pedestal to like be this perfect family. And so I remember very young, you know, learning to put the mask on.
Right.
And that was pretty hard. But for the most part, like I would have to agree, like it was positive, you know, you learn positive values and it's a close community, yeah. you know, it's already a small town and it's a small church, like everybody's related. So yeah, I would say that was pretty positive.
Yeah.
For the most part.
Right.
Yeah.
So what was maybe the first, you know, the first things that you noticed, and maybe it wasn't a big thing, but what was maybe the first thing that each of you noticed where you thought, oh, maybe it's not a perfect bubble, you know, like I thought, or maybe, you know, it's not a flawless, you know, organization that I'm a part of. And I know, especially being on the road as a missionary kid, you probably got to see you probably saw warts and all traveling to different churches and got to see a broad spectrum. But what were some of the first things that you noticed where you felt, you know, maybe uncomfortable or thought, hey, maybe this isn't quite right?
Maybe this is slightly off topic, but like I do remember, like I was just a little girl, like all of 8 years old, and I'm playing in my room. And then all of a sudden I get this thought, I wonder if I'm in a cult. And then I would just go back to playing my Barbies. Like these thoughts would start popping in my head. So like, that's the first like instance, nothing. I don't know how that came into my head, into my being. Like I want to say now that it was definitely God, leading, but
you can't think of something that like prompted that, it just kind of popped up.
Yeah, I think so. Can you think of any? I need a minute.
Yeah. I'll say for myself. So like I was really sold out in it, like, you know, going to Bible camp, getting all excited, you know, loving the Lord and all that kind of stuff. And it wasn't until like later on when like something came up with Easter or Christmas. And, you know, I was sold out and thinking, oh yeah, we do everything by the Bible.
Right.
And like, you know, it's that's our foundation. You know, we do all this because it says it in the Bible. And then there were some traditions that I heard about the origins of, like with Chris, like not all Christmas, but like, you know, it's like the kind of stuff that floats to the top and people talk about.
Right.
And like, I had some unsaved family that would bring up Christmas a lot. So I brought that up to my pastor and I kind of laid out the weird stuff in Easter, like with the eggs and dyeing them, like the weird origins there. And when I brought that up to my pastor, her dad, and he said, it's like, Norman, I can't give you an answer for any of those. I just know we got to keep doing it, because what will I tell my wife? And I remember that hit me. It was like weird, because I'm like, you know, we do things by the Bible. I'm talking to the leader of the church that holds the Bible, and he couldn't give an answer for any of this. And his answer was, what will I tell my wife? And it was like, ah, man, it stinks. You know, that's what was like chipping away at me. Like, yeah.
So yeah, I think mine was also like way later, as in like, what, 5 years ago?
Yeah.
Because like same thing, I was like sold out. What I thought was just like a relationship with God. Like I thought that the Baptist doctrine and the Bible were the same thing. I did not realize at this point that it was two different. Well, not, I don't want to say two different things, but like I thought we went by the Bible, and I, you know, since then have learned like, no, it's the Baptist doctrine first, then the Bible.
Right.
And so I remember when we were down in Winkler at my brother's graduation, we had already been like slowly coming to different conclusions. Like we're reading the Bible. We're not like just reading one verse and then like closing the book and saying, okay, that's good enough for today. Yeah. Like we're like reading chapters and we're like, oh snap. Like this is kind of different from what we've learned. So we're sitting in the service and the pastor, I don't know, he's basically, what did he say? He was like basically like, yeah, we found someone propagating, what did he say? He was like,
yeah, he was saying like, there was a guy in the church and he always sat in the back row and he started questioning and he was bringing up materials and talking and he like just got rid of him, right?
Yeah, just got rid of him. He just like threw him out of the church. And yeah. Like, and I remember me and Norman sitting there and we were just like, okay, like that's kind of freaky. Yeah. And like, we remember like our family was around, because, my dad's a pastor and so is my brother-in-law, pastor missionaries. And, they were all like, amen, amen. And we're sitting like, this is really eerie.
Yeah. Yeah. They just stamped out someone who was just questioning in the church and they were talking about it like it was a big victory.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I would say that was my first. I mean, like I've always had, you know, those little moments, but like nothing that was monumental, I would say.
Right.
Until then.
That was a big point for me. I mean, sexual abuse was one of the things that burst the bubble. Like that was what made me start really digging in and looking at like the chains of this stuff that was happening in the movement. But one of the things that really shook me was when I started really studying my faith for myself, I would watch a lot of debates. I would watch a lot of, you know, like moderated debates and speeches you know, let people explore two different opinions on baptism, on all these different things. And I just remember I would see these colleges, these Bible colleges hosting these debates. And then I would think back at like every college I had, you know, considered going to at West Coast or Hiles Intercell. I was like, they would never bring somebody on stage to talk about, is the King James Bible the only inspired text, or is, you know, or end times, or any of the doctrines. It was preaching that, it was authoritative preaching that, you know, affirmed that position over and over again until you could affirm it.
Yes.
And so that was my thing where I was like, you know, again, I always bounce back and forth between using the label cult, but I think when you look at the movement broadly, the way that it handles information is very cultish at best.
Yeah.
So I do want to circle back a little bit. And like I said before, you know, feel free to share as much or as little as you'd like to. Mm-hmm. But I know prior to realizing like the doctrinal side, you had an experience with sexual abuse in the church. How did that impact you at that time? And what was kind of, I know you're going from church to church and involved in a lot of different ministries. Like how did that situation unfold, at such an early age?
Okay. Well, I'll first say like, we were classified as missionaries, but I felt like we were more a pastor's family. Like, so, why I say that is like, my dad was like in a missionary setting, I don't think I'm the original person that said this, but like in a missionary setting, you take your family with you to do stuff and go places and all that stuff. But with our family, it was more like the pastor where my dad went and did stuff and we were just at home. Yeah. So like dad was busy doing whatever he was doing. And it actually happened like right in our little house behind the church. And it was this, I think he was like 15 years old. I was like 9 or 10. It's a little fuzzy. Like, I'll be honest. It's not, it's like I'm still looking at a movie playing. Like,
yeah,
that's where I'm at. It's not like I'm there experiencing it. It's like just looking. And so he was like, he was a good deal older than me. He was, you know, like obviously 15, 16. So like, I don't know, I would say like a normal teenage guy would be interested in like a teenage girl, but he was going after a young girl. Like he knew what he was doing. And yeah, he, the three times that I remember happened right in my room. And I had a witness, my friend, she was in there all three times that we remember. And I remember, like, I don't remember saying anything to him. He tried to do it to my friend, and she said, like, no, get away. And he was, you know, saying, oh, it'll be fun. Like, he's just, I don't know, he's not a good guy.
Yeah.
And I remember that, I don't know if it, I don't know when exactly it happened, but I was in the dark in my room. I had like a loft bed, and there's this ladder going up to it. I was hiding underneath the ladder in the dark, and my mom came to me and said, what's going on? And I said, I'm hiding from this man. And I said his name. And the funny thing is, I don't remember what she said. Like, but she didn't question it any further. It was kind of just like this hush hush. Never went to my dad, because I just told dad and mom like 2 years ago.
Yeah
about this all. Because I forget, you know, like with like trauma, some you forget for periods, decade, or you know, however long. And I would remember and then blank out for like years. And I was actually at my brother's graduation, the same one, you know, with the service. And I was just talking late at night with my brother, and I said, oh, like we're just talking. And I was like, so, you know, when this person molested me. And he played it cool. And then later he went to his wife and he's like, did you know? And she's like, no, I had no idea. And he came back down to me and he said, like, Angie, like this kind of stuff, like you don't cover that up.
No.
And for that, like, I feel like my brother will like always be a hero to me,
yeah.
You know, 'cause he was, like he was heavily involved in the ministry. He was going to be a preacher. And like, so that was really cool. And I think that's what kind of launched me into this, all the way up to being on your podcast.
Right. Yeah. Right. Now, so what do you think it was at the time? I mean, I know obviously you said like it's easy to blank out over certain things, or like, you know, when you're looking at a young age, you're trying to communicate what happened. You're trying to explain the best you can. Do you feel like your mom just didn't fully understand the situation, or do you feel it was something where it was just this, it was a culture of just like, we just don't address it, just keep it quiet and, you know, move forward? Or do you not, are you not sure? Cause I know for me, like, you know, I think back on things that I try to explain as a kid. And that's one of the hardest things, is you want to believe your parents when they say, oh, we didn't truly get what you were trying to tell us, or we didn't, but you're also sitting there going like, how could I have been more clear? You know, at the time I felt like I was being crystal clear. So, at the time, did you feel like she really registered what happened, or?
Man, like, I feel like they should have known, because like, this guy was like super touchy and like, I mean, he was always around. Like he was, came from a troubled home and, you know, my parents were very much into like, let's rescue people. and so, yeah, I really do think that I will never understand like why she didn't pursue. And I do feel like if my trust wasn't already broken in my parents, it definitely was then.
Yeah.
Like I knew that I couldn't. Yeah.
Yeah. So when you had that conversation with your brother, and I mean, like you said, like hero, like someone to address that what happened was wrong and to, you know, essentially validate what you've been sitting there caring as like, am I overreacting? Am I missing something? Mm-hmm. So for him to say that is huge. But how did that change how you started addressing it? Did you just become more vocal about it? Is it something where, you know, how did you broach that subject differently after that conversation?
I think I became more vocal and I started to try to, internalize that, like, I'm not going to ruin his life. He already's done that. Like, I just seen your little clip the other day, you know, and I was like, yeah, 100%. Like, it's not my fault. And I do remember that, me telling myself when I would remember what happened, I would say, well, he's different now, you know, and I'm going to ruin his life. He has, you know, he has his wife now and 4 children.
Yeah.
And like, I would just make excuses and like, it was all on me. And so I feel like that when my brother said, like, don't do this, like you can't cover this. And, so yeah, I think that was the switch. Like I started to get vocal, actually went to the police and, like, oh man, it was like way past the, what is it called? The
statute of limitations.
Yeah. Yeah. It was way past that, unfortunately. But I don't know.
It kind of got triggered like the heat started being turned on to talk about this when you spoke with his wife.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. So it's like a little bit of a story. It's really messed up. I became friends with his wife, just one winter and,
through the church still?
Yeah. Through the church. Okay. Yep. And so, yeah, I started to like just go on long walks with her in the winter. Like there's nothing else to do. So we did that. And well, okay, I have to back up just a little bit. Like, so I am very much like, in the culture, like in the North, like, they pretty much call me like an albino native. So like for me to befriend his wife was different for me, like, because she's white. And, I usually don't do that, but I feel like this is an important detail because like, I remember that winter very strongly. It might as well have been God just saying it out loud to me, like, befriend this woman. And so I was like, this is weird, but I'll do it. And so I did. And like, man, I found out why. He was abusing his wife. Who knows, like, probably still is, because he's still not caught, you know, like this guy is still in the church right now.
Yeah.
As we speak.
And
so is his poor wife, and he has 4 children, and so he was, I don't know how much I want to go into detail, but he was.
Yeah, he was like, I mean, we listened to a couple of the podcasts, and it gets, you know, deep. He was like, just from the conversations Angie had with his wife. And again, this is a guy that's doing like our music, and he
was almost our pastor.
He was almost our pastor at one point, and he's like, at that time, I don't know, he was like doing a lot of things in the church and seeking leadership and all that stuff. And from his wife, they were like filming pornography together. And
like webcamming.
Yeah, and like selling it and stuff, and trading photos with locals, like in our small town. And that kind of stuff was going on. And like,
and you could see it. Like, I remember seeing her a couple times before I knew what was happening, before she let me in. And she looked absolutely crazy. Like she was going crazy. Mm. And I wondered, like, what the heck is going on? And then I find all this stuff out. I remember why I learned it too. She was leaving down south. Her husband got into college, and so they were leaving. I don't know, the next day, a couple days from there. And I remember, like, my heart was pounding as we're walking, and I couldn't not tell her that I had got molested as a child by her husband. Like, I couldn't shake it. She couldn't leave town without knowing this. And right when I told her that, it was really weird, because like, she didn't act surprised, and that was eerie for me. And then she tells me all what he had been doing, and I just remember coming back to Norman. I was just shaking, you know, like, this is really messed up. We got to do something. We got to help her. And so I forget what we did. I think we called my dad for sure.
Yeah.
And who wasn't the pastor anymore. Like, he had already switched the pastorate to a young man, Riley Featherstone.
Yeah.
And so we called him, and we're like, Dad, like, something has to happen here. And I think we did call Riley as well.
Yeah, it was so awkward too, because like, Angie at the beginning of the year, the beginning of winter, was like really getting close with his wife, Sky's wife. And in the middle of that, we had gotten kicked out of church. So like, here we are now, they're getting ready to go. And I'm having to call the pastor and the guy kicked us out, and like, say, hey, you know, let's put these things aside for now, and let's
help her.
Like, this is, she's still our sister in the faith. She needs help. And we got your dad and Riley on the phone to get something done about this.
Yeah.
And
I think they, like, my dad did try, I would say that I kind of pushed him into that, really, like, kind of begged him to help. And so he did, he tried. But just hearing conversations, like, afterward, I feel that the blame is still put on this lady. Hmm. Like, it's her fault, and like, she should come forward. It's her life. It's, you know, and all this kind of stuff. And like, for me, that's kind of dumb, because like, how is a person supposed to come forward, and like, what is she supposed to do? She has four kids. And you know that world. It's like, she doesn't have a job, she doesn't have any source of anything, and she's just supposed to like, okay, yeah, I'm gonna just turn in my husband. Like, you need to have support to do that. Hmm. And putting the blame on her, like, that's not gonna do anything.
Right. Yeah, it's I have to imagine going through this. The fact that, even knowing it's not her fault, but the fact that you reached out and made a friendship with someone who, you know, I can't imagine it was easy, you know what I mean? Knowing her, who she was with, and knowing that at some point that conversation was going to happen. But, you know, sitting back and watching that situation unfold. So you're now a third party to a situation where you're trying to help, but can't, mm-hmm. and you're seeing this cold response. Did that stir up, you know, or did that trigger any memories to, you know, being a 9-year-old kid trying to explain and getting that same cold reception. Because I have to imagine, like, as traumatizing as that situation was then, seeing it play out again with somebody else, and that's got to evoke some deep feeling that's, you know, probably retreaded a lot of the same emotions you felt way back then. Was it at that point, were you guys still members of that church or not yet? You had already left.
We didn't leave.
Or you had already been kicked out.
Forcibly. Right. Yeah.
That's a nice way to say it. You left. I mean, when you're seeing now, looking from the outside in, and you're examining this, why do you think that there was such a blame placed on the victims in these situations and not on the person responsible? I mean, this is the same person, two different instances, the first of which should have been enough for some action to be taken. Why do you think that there was such a cold reception to this news?
Well, I mean, I think I know, you know, like, I guess I can't like pry into someone's head space, but like my dad has kind of, you know, made comments along the lines where, like, you know, if this gets out, like, it's going to destroy the ministry. Mm-hmm. And the whole, you know, the whole Northern ministry that has been in the works for like over 30 years, it's all going to fall.
Yeah. It's like, it's our church was like the hub for all these smaller communities around them.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And that pressure, and he was telling us, like, you know, if this place falls, then all these other communities will fall with it. Like, the IFB backbone is this church.
Right.
And yeah, that's kind of weight he was throwing on us.
Yeah.
In conversation.
Yeah. Yeah. And I remember telling my mom kind of recently in a text, like this is so fragile. Like, the truth, like, it stands, you know, like, you don't have to defend it. You don't have to do anything. The truth is the truth. And you know, Jesus is the truth. And like, why are we being defensive about this? Like, that doesn't seem like a strong foundation that we teach. That doesn't sound like the rock. Right. That sounds like sand, you know, like the foolish man built his house upon the sand.
Yeah.
Feels like that.
Yeah.
I don't get it.
Hey, everybody, we're going to get back to the show in just a minute. But before our brief intermission, I'd like to introduce a thought-provoking new podcast called Psychotherapy. That's two words if you're going to go search for it right now. This show sheds light on the very real issue of abusive therapists and pastoral counselors. In every helping profession, including therapy, there's a vulnerability to exploitation. And Psychotherapy delves deep into the red flags, risks, and real-life stories of those affected by unethical practices. Tune in to Psychotherapy with Leah Denton on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your shows.
I'm Leah Denton, and this is Psychotherapy, a show dedicated to providing survivors of therapy harm a platform to share their stories and to offer language for those of us trying to make sense of our own experiences with the psycho in the therapist chair.
Yeah, at that point, you're essentially doing the way corporate America would handle this stuff, or the way that, you know, a company would handle it. You're worried about the brand more than, you know, having, again, this security. And, you know, I address this all the time, but I mean, the idea that, you know, talking about this stuff or exposing this stuff is going to do damage. I mean, it's like when you're a kid, it's like you can share the information and the circumstances will be a little bit less extreme, or you can wait till someone finds out. And, you know, I don't understand that. I don't understand this idea of, you know, if we can keep it concealed long enough, it won't hurt us. Cause this stuff always finds its way out. Mm-hmm. And, I want to cover one more thing, and this is a conversation that's come up quite a bit, just in the last couple of weeks, just in private conversations. But I know one thing with, one thing you mentioned was sharing something when, you know, he has a family, he's got kids now, you know, he's got a wife. And up until that point, you know, you're unsure of how the relationship is. I mean, until you start really getting to talk to them. how did you, I guess, come to the point where you were able to ask those kind of questions and kind of confide in her what had happened? Because I know one argument I get, and I'm not asking this as like, I'm not sure, because I kind of know how I feel about it, but I've had a lot of people that say, you know, hey, when you post the name of somebody who's committed one of these crimes, or when you bring up that so-and-so is still in a staff position, aren't you also, you know, creating victims of their families and bringing unnecessary attention to them? Mm-hmm. And, you know, while I can kind of understand the concern, you still have to share that information. You still have to understand that they're the ones who put themselves in that position. So you have to, there is always going to be damage. There is always going to be collateral damage from, you know, the choices that people make. But I guess, what would you say to people who are maybe in similar situations, are wanting to broach something a couple years later, you know, 10 years later, when things seem to have settled, but there's something, this huge elephant in the room that hasn't been addressed? What would you say to them? And how did you kind of get to that place where you were able to talk about it and feel like you're going about it the right way?
I honestly, I don't know. Like, what would I tell them? I mean, like, if it's somebody else, like if it's, you know, if you know something about somebody else and it's like that kind of situation, then I would say that, like, you have to understand that, like I know this person is your friend and you don't want them to be hurt. Obviously, like, no one wants them to be like more put in the fire, you know, or put right. in a bad yeah. position. So I would say, like, definitely talk to someone that you trust. I would say, unfortunately, not the church and not a pastor. Yeah. Unfortunately, like, I have to put that in, but you know, talk to somebody you trust and figure out maybe a plan, you know, so that they can have support. Yeah. So that when you tell them to do something hard, that you have a plan for them to actually right. Do the hard deed. Yeah. And just realize that, I mean, like, realize, like, for my friend's situation, I don't think she's capable anymore of making sound decisions. I'm not saying she's crazy. I'm not saying that. I'm saying that, like, when you're groomed, when you're abused, mentally, yeah. emotionally, physically, if all those, if you're abused, like, you're going to be kind of off kilter in your decisions. And you have to realize that. And I think that's the most frustrating part with all this, you know, with telling my parents and hearing them kind of just say it's all on her and stuff. Yeah. And they're not realizing or putting themselves in her shoes. Like,
yeah. Right.
She can't make these decisions. Like, she needs help. Like, yeah. She obviously needs help. That's why she told me. So, I guess that's a roundabout answer.
It was a roundabout question. I mean, it's just something that I think about a lot. And I think that, just to be completely transparent, it's come up quite a bit the last few days. Cause I posted something about the church that I grew up in. It's the first time I've named the church I grew up in the eight months I've done the show. People who know me know when I say the church I grew up in, but yeah. It was the first time I ever really named it. And there were a lot of people who reached out who were pretty upset and were, you know, like, it's so many years later, it's this. And, you know, I guess the thing I struggle with is I feel that. I understand that there is no way to do any of this stuff. There's no way to do this show. There's no way to talk about abuse in the church without people being hurt. And it's not a... Even if my intention's not to hurt somebody, even if my intention's not to, you know, bring attention to people who don't need the attention on them, mm-hmm. You know, you also have to think about the greater protection of others. And mm-hmm. so, you know, when I look at these situations and, you know, so many of the men, I mean, a man today that I had to share an article about, who, you know, was arrested for horrific things. He's got, you know, little kids and a wife. Mm-hmm. And I, as a dad, I feel that, like, I feel that knowing, like, they're affected by this. They're affected by what he did. They're affected by, you know, all these people who thought they knew their dad and thought they knew. And, you know, I always take that into consideration, but it's also, it's just a hard place. That's a hard situation. And it's easy to, forget that they put themselves and their families into that situation. It's not the people who are pointing at it. It's, it's that situation, but it is, it's something, you know, like I said, it's a roundabout question because it's something that, you know, I wish there was a way to address this without, you know, without having to worry about all these other fragmented pieces that are connected. And even too, I mean, this is a church you grew up in. This is, you know, for me, I spent 18 years at a church, you know, and even though you may disagree with everything, even though you may disagree with doctrines and, you know, you may have people that treat you that way, there's so many good memories tied into this place and there's so your childhood and to explain that to people and say, you know, hey, I wish that I didn't have to talk about how I grew up in any kind of negative way. I wish I didn't have to go through the way that people that I really trusted, you know, turn their back or fill in the blank. So I was just curious to kind of know, like, cause I mean, props to you. I mean, I know that his wife's not responsible, but I mean, that's a hard relationship to build. And I can't, you know, anything that brings back those memories is a hard place to be in. So, I mean, I give you tons of respect for that. I do want to ask this too, because I mean, one thing that also comes up quite a bit on the show is, you know, supporting people who've been through traumatic events. And I know, Norman, like you're coming at this and, you know, trying to help and encourage, just like, I mean, just like your brother was, Angie, like trying to explain like, hey, that's not okay. Stepping in as a support role, like what's some of the best ways to support people who've been through traumatic situations? And, I mean, how can you encourage people who are, you know, speaking out for the first time?
Just hearing them and reacting humanly. I kind of carry it with me. I shouldn't though, but you know, we're all kind of dumb back then. Angie had told me like a good, maybe like when we first started dating or like maybe a year after dating that this guy had,
and that was around her. What age?
Oh, that was like 18, 19. So like 10 years ago now.
Okay.
And she had told me that this guy abused her, and like, I'm like an 18-year-old. And I'm just kind of like there, like, huh,
yeah,
wow, that's weird. And then I just moved on, and I look back and I was like, why did I do that? You know, like this is serious. And I think it was the same thing with Ange. It's like he's trying to be our pastor now. He has a family, so that should be, you know, just we all did stupid things in our youth. That's the kind of stuff that was going through my mind. But recently, like, with a better head on my shoulders and her brother and Angie telling me this, and even the man's wife spoke to me directly, asking for help. And like all I could do, what I could do was like listen and react like, wow, that's horrible what happened. Like that's really screwed up and that's not normal. When Angie shared and me and her brother started talking and like really like pointing out like how screwed up the whole situation really is, that's what really got it going. It was like, man, you're right. This is really bad. You know, and he's trying to be in leadership here. And then when his wife told me, it's the same thing. I was like, you know, that's not normal what he's doing. And this is wrong. Yeah. And, you know, and I shared with her just like, whatever we can do to help. Like Angie actually had got her lined up a place for her to stay if she needed like to separate for a while. Like all these things. And as a support now with Angie and at the time with this man's wife, it just came down to, reacting like a regular human being.
Yeah.
That this situation is wrong.
Yeah.
And I got to share something like along those lines too, because, you know, this guy, he's like big time gaslit his wife and gaslit our pastor about Angie's situation. Hmm. Like, I don't know, this, the gall he has, like, before we contacted the police, we had let a summer go because he was going to be getting therapy, or not therapy, what's
counseling.
Counseling. Yeah. Counseling. Yeah. Counseling. And her brother, the church he went to had a really, really strong, you know, counseling program to work with guys that are into this kind of stuff and
right.
to get them out of it, like hardcore, like all these guys, I think were former, they're men and they knew, you know, how to see through the lies, see through the manipulation. And our pastor that this all fell in his lap, he knows about this place. And we shared with them like, hey, you know, there's a independent fundamental Baptist counseling place down south. And he said, no, the Lord will give me my ability to counsel him. Hmm. And I was like, oh, okay. This is like pretty rough stuff. And he's only a year older than me. And like, you know, I know he's a pastor, but still, you know, we don't have all that experience. And
right.
Anyways, he counseled him for like a summer. And we thought, you know, hey, if he repents, whatever, does his thing. By the end of the summer, he had contacted Angie's dad like 3 times mm-hmm. in private. And
when the pastor was out of town.
Yeah.
Like, really sneaky.
Because her dad was obviously upset about what he did. Obviously, he's a dad. And he was reacting normally. And he had contacted him like 3 separate occasions privately. Like, I know this because me and her dad had a hunting trip and he was really opening up, really encouraging us to go to the police. And it tipped me over each time, or at least the last time, he stated that Angie's lying, that I didn't abuse her, it was someone else. And I was thinking, like, you had a whole summer of counseling, and out of it you got, oh, I'm not accountable, or he's still denying it. Yeah. And that's what really pushed us to go to the police, because it was like, you know, the church isn't doing its job. And
because we tried to put it to Riley, you know, to the pastor, we tried to put it to other people, and
yeah,
they just kept on throwing it back at us.
Yeah.
Like, we're the only people that can ever do anything about this.
Yeah.
It's absolutely crazy. And it's,
to go around, it's going around about supporting. And it really broke my heart, because, like, you know, his wife shared with Angie, and she had told us, like, I told your dad already, and he didn't do anything about this, the pastor. And I told Norman already, and he didn't do anything about this. And I'm thinking, this is my first time I'm hearing this, and I'm, like, horrified by this. And it just shows the level of manipulation. This guy had said that he went to Angie's dad and went to me and the pastor and had said, yeah, I told them
everything
we were doing, and they're all okay with it, including me. And this is messed up, man. So she's sitting there getting like the opposite of support, you know, she's calling out for help, and it's making us look like we're just sitting on our hands. It's just really messed up there.
Right.
And I was happy that I was able to share with her, you know, real emotion, real support, both me and Angie. And to know he's still doing that to our pastor now, telling her dad and telling the pastor, oh, I didn't do anything. I didn't abuse Angie at all.
Yeah.
And
I mean, thankfully I had parents that actually believed me.
Yeah.
I know that isn't, you know, everybody's case. Yeah. So I do feel very blessed that they believe me. Actually, anybody that I say, like, oh, this person did it, they're like, yep, he gave me the creeps. Like,
no.
Yeah.
So, I mean, obviously this is canon. I don't have many cases out of that area. So how does the statute of limitations work there? And like what, because it seems like it's a pretty narrow window. Because I mean, because you're what, mid-20s coming forward about it when it was going to the police or?
Yeah.
Yeah. I think I would have been 27.
Yeah.
Yeah. Something like that. And then when it happened.
So about 18 years or so, 19 years.
I guess I didn't actually like exactly look up, but like I did go to the police and it's kind of annoying because they didn't like, who was I listening to? I was listening to your podcast. I think it was Rachel Peach that like they gave her the option to catch this guy on the phone.
Right.
And I go into the RCMP, sit down, and they're like, okay, so you want us to keep an eye on him, right? I'm like, no, I'm here to charge him. And they didn't even, no options for a phone call, nothing like that. Mm. And
they had taken her statement.
Yeah.
And they had taken her friend that saw it.
Eyewitness.
Yeah. Eyewitness that's happening to her. Mm. And it was a big process of like sitting there, all giving our statements, everything. And then it was really anticlimactic. Just two police officers showed up to our door and said, it's not enough evidence. And it was too long ago and just moved on. And I was like,
That's where it would be really valuable, you know, if his wife did come forward.
Because there's recent stuff that could be brought up.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, for sure. Like, you know, I think Canada's pretty big on, like, even, you know, marital rape, which is, like, unknown in the IFB churches.
Right.
You know, I tell people that, and they look at me like I'm absolutely insane.
Yeah.
I'm like, it's, you can, yeah, that's, that can happen.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, that's where it's interesting. The more distance you put between you and that movement is that there's so many flippant things that you throw out as like, well, of course, you know, in that world, this is the case or this, or, you know, or women shouldn't, you know, women can't say no to their husbands, you know, like you throw out those statements and people just look at you like, are you kidding? Were you going to church in the 1800s or the, you know, it's like, what do you, but it was so normal. Like all of that stuff was so normalized. And even in these situations, like him being a male in the church, you know, gives him such a leg up in any situation, legal or not. And so, so, I mean, you guys are still, I mean, obviously you guys aren't in the IFB. What's kind of your view now, like looking out on the movement as a whole? And, you know, I ask this of everybody as we, you know, as we get to the end of episodes is when you see these cases so similar, even you mentioned Rachel Peach, she's Southern California experiencing similar things to what you experienced in Canada. And you're hearing stories from Indiana and Florida and all over the place.
Yeah.
Do you think that these problems are products of the IFB where, you know, with a few tweaks, the IFB could be reformed and changed and we could avoid these things? Or do you think they are results of the teaching and kind of, you know, mindset of the independent Baptist world?
Hmm. I think Angie said it before with the IFB in the North is already so small.
Yeah.
And like our church, I think it's like the only non-missionary church that actually has a local pastor. And I don't know, the system seems pretty hell-bent on protecting itself.
Right.
And that's definitely systemic inside the IFB. Like, just defending the brand. You said it actually, the brand.
Right.
And
that fragility of the movement where
it
can so easily be broken
if
you let anything get out. Yeah.
And there's so much weight to keep this place up and running and keep other places up and running that they'll let a lot of things slide.
Right.
So reformed? I don't know. It's
well, I mean, like I don't know what podcast it was. We kind of binged your podcast. And you were talking about like the stats, or someone was, or the percentage, like how there's more pedophiles in the IFB churches than like the Roman Catholic. No. And okay, so like just based on that, like in the Bible, it talks about bad fruit, right?
Right.
You can only have good fruit or bad fruit. Like there's no in between. Yeah. And so if there's a bunch of bad fruit coming out, then you have to look at the source of why it's causing that problem.
Yeah.
And if they're unwilling, and at least it was in our case, they're unwilling to look at the source, then like, no, there's no hope. And if, as long as you keep moving away from, you know, like upholding the Baptist doctrine over the Bible, like that's not good, you know, like, it kind of reminds me of Pharisees in a way.
It's
I mean, when you said how fragile, I mean, that's something that keeps circling in my mind whenever I look at it, is there's such a, you know, and I see it. I see it when now there's IFP pastors, I mean, between the things that I'm doing and there's other podcasts doing similar things. And now it's making their sermons where they're saying, you know, these sites that are, you know, quote unquote, tearing down the church or attacking pastors. And it's just the fact that there's such an insecurity in what they believe, and for, you know, for believing that they have God on their side, it seems like they're doing a lot of work to proactively protect themselves. And so like, sorry, go ahead.
Like that was a big thing, like coming out of it was learning to separate that, like when they get up on their platforms, like when they open their mouths, God actually isn't speaking through them, word for word. And it doesn't matter if you pray a prayer and say, like, you know, the pastor will close his eyes and say, like, you know, God speak through me and don't let me say whatever, you know, like, don't let words come out of my mouth that shouldn't, like, it doesn't matter. Like, because if he can veer off at any point, like, and we've seen it happen multiple times. We walk in, you know, when we were kicked, after we were kicked out, we'd, you know, go in and all of a sudden the messages would just take a sharp turn and like just attack. And it took a while for me to like separate, like, oh, okay. Like they're actually going out on their own right now and like speaking not for God. Like,
That's something where it gets lost in the IFB a lot, is, you know, that kind of Berean attitude, like, you know, searching scriptures to see if what's being said is true. And that was such a corner, like that was something commendable. And, you know, I don't know if it was this like this for you, but I just remember, you know, pastor saying like, don't be going through your Bible right now. Look up here, you know, listen to what I'm saying. And it's like, that seems like the opposite of what we should be doing in churches, like maybe eyes off you and in the word. But, so, I guess just, I know I always say one last question, but really one last question. You mentioned the extreme weight of being in the movement and being, you know, you already have that weight. Everybody, even outside the church, has that weight of what if I destroy someone's life, or, you know, all of those misconceptions that our natural, you know, mind tells us to feel. But then having the weight of, am I going to destroy this religion? Am I going to hurt Christianity? Like, so I guess, and both of you can answer this, but especially Angie, I want to know from you, what would you say to someone who's sitting in the pew of one of these churches, is holding on to this horrible secret of something that happened, and they're sitting there with all this added weight from the church to not come forward? What would you say to them, and what would you encourage them to do with that feeling, and how would you encourage them to come forward regardless of that?
I mean, like, okay, so I was watching an HBO series. This sounds so random, but it has a point. I was watching an HBO series, Chernobyl, and this one phrase, like I'll never forget it. He was saying, where I once would fear the cost of truth, Now I only ask, what is the cost of lies?
Mm.
And wow. That really hit me hard. Like, I have it on my Facebook profile. Like, I love it. And, right. And also the other thing that, personally, like, motivated me was, you know, the verse where the truth will set you free.
Right.
And I think that's where it has to come down to. You have to, let the truth in, and whatever that means for you, you know, like, going to a trusted individual, you know, like, whether it's like your spouse or your brother or whoever, and, you know, talking with them. And again, like, the church has made their decisions and made their bed, and, you're not responsible for that.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not responsible for that. That's why I'm on this podcast. Like, I'm not covering for anybody anymore. Right. Like, that's their problem. And, I'm not here because I hate them. It's actually the opposite. Like, I want people to realize that, like, I still care. And, but you have to stand on the truth. You have to, like, or else it's going to crumble, going to fall. Eventually, it will.
Right.
And so, yeah, I guess I would just encourage that, like, count the cost of the lies, you know?
Wow. Yeah, I mean, I think that's a great place to close out. And I'm definitely going to steal that quote for future stuff. I'll probably make a post right when I'm done with this. But no, I really appreciate you both sharing. And it's definitely a difficult position to be in. It's definitely interesting hearing. And I mean, it's sad hearing that even outside the U.S., like, seeing this stuff happen in Canada and this network of churches where, you know, it just keeps spreading, and there's these situations, like I said, from the West Coast to the East Coast to North, South, like, these stories keep replicating themselves. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think, like you said, I think until we start counting the cost of, seriously stacking up these lies about what's really happening, the more it's going to happen. And it's painful to dig through it. It's painful to talk about, share, but it's a lot. I mean, there's a lot more pain being stored up when we keep it quiet and wait for things to really hit their boiling point. But, thank you both so much for coming on and for sharing. And it's incredibly brave to share your story. And I know it's not easy. So I appreciate you doing that. And I appreciate you for using this platform to do that. That means a lot to me. And, I can't thank you enough.
Hey, well, thank you. Like, seriously. You.
We got introduced by my friend, and before that, we literally thought we were the only people. Yeah. Like, we didn't know that people like you exist.
Yeah.
With voices and platforms.
And just, like, Angie wasn't joking, we're binging it, and I'm thinking, like, wow, you know, like, this stuff is going on. Like, the girls' homes and, like, the crazy crap just all over, and it's so encouraging to hear people speaking up. And you being able to use your platform to get those voices out there and encourage people like us that are, you know, we feel alone in this, we feel abused, and there are people that are standing up, and it's awesome, man. Really, really awesome.
Yeah.
Awesome. Yeah. Thank you. I mean, thank you guys so much. And, you know, I said at the beginning, these are always awkward conversations to start and end because it is, you know, I know we're meeting for the first time and talking through, you know, some of the worst, the worst experiences that we can all talk about. But, like I said, it was good getting to meet both of you, and hope to stay in touch over the next couple months and, you know, we'll figure this out together, I guess.
Yeah.
So, totally.
Yes.
Totally.
Thank you for listening to the Preacher Boys podcast. If you appreciated the content on the show, please leave a review on iTunes, and don't forget to connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter with the handle @PreacherBoysDoc. Additional information can always be found on PreacherBoysDoc.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.